The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
What if your dreams weren't random at all, but instead they were messages from the deepest parts of your mind? Today we're going to step inside the Museum of Dreams, where every dream, fear, and strange nighttime story may reveal something powerful about who we are. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and this is Sleep Science Today. We are going to be talking with Professor Sharon Slavinsky, who is also author of the book, An Alphabet for Dreamers, How to See the World with Eyes Closed. Welcome, Professor.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I was sharing with you before we started recording this episode that I've been looking forward to this because it's such a unique topic. And I was looking at your website, which we'll share with the audience, and there's just so much here. So let's start off with something. Why don't we start off with having you explain how you came to research the social and political dimensions of dreams. Let's start with that.
Yeah, I'm happy to start there. I've always been interested. I mean, who's not interested in dreams? I mean, we all are because we all have them, and they're baffling and perplexing and mysterious experiences. But I started off my career as a scholar of different kinds of images. I study visual studies is technically my field, and I've worked a lot. I began my career studying the relationship between images and human rights. So if you can think of things like photographs of, you know, from the Nazi camps, for example, the way those photographs propelled the very idea of human rights.
Right.
So I know a lot about images, just not so, you know, I hadn't studied dreams. And people, for example, in art history don't study dreams, even though they are a kind of image. And so I was on my way to a conference in Australia to talk about visual culture and human rights. And it was a very long flight. The conference was, in Australia. So I picked up Nelson Mandela's autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. I had never read it before, and he had just died. So I picked it up. I thought, oh, great, great, great companion book. And right there in the middle of that autobiography, Mandela reports having a recurring nightmare while he was imprisoned in Robben Island. Hmm. And I just thought, what is this? What is this story? You know, he's not given to talk about his private life a lot. And I was hooked. I was fascinated. From there on, I was thought, okay, there's something to be said here about these kinds of images and how they have a social and political dimension.
Wow. Wow. So, okay. But that was just sort of a little teaser to get you thinking about that. So how did that get you going in even deeper?
Yeah, well, the nightmare itself is a fascinating one. And it's about him leaving prison and making his way back home, which, I mean, if you're in prison for 27 years, that makes sense to have as a nightmare. If you're incarcerated for that long, you know, getting out of prison would be a familiar dream. But what's fascinating about that nightmare is that in the dream, he says he gets out of prison. In the dream, the prison is in Johannesburg, where his trial was. And he gets out into the world, and there's no one there. There's no people, there's no cars, there's no taxis. The world is completely empty. And he walks all the way from Johannesburg to his home in Soweto, which is a suburb. You know, it would have taken many hours. In the dream, he's walking, walking, walking. And he gets to this beloved house of his, and there's no one there. The house is empty. It's a ghost house. And I started thinking about the content of that dream, the content of that image, like I would any other image. You know, I took it as a kind of testimony to Mandela's experience. Mm-hmm. And thinking about it that way, you know, understanding the content of the dream as being meaningful to his experience of apartheid, of the very particular form of political violence that was happening in South Africa at that time. And so the dream is testifying to that experience of being someone who was banned and was, you know, taking the challenge of of that form of political violence head on and face consequences by being imprisoned. So I started thinking about dreams as carrying this kind of testimony, this kind of evidence for our lived experience. And it turns out there's a few people historically who've done that before, but it was kind of a new idea to try to think of dreams as a kind of testimony to our experience.
Mm-hmm. So as you're kind of processing these things for yourself, is there a distinction for you between like dreams and nightmares, or it doesn't matter because they're all just stories of what's going on in our mind?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I'm a big fan of the both and answer, mm-hmm. which is to say, yes, there is technically, I think, for clinicians, there is a distinction between dreams and nightmares. And when nightmares get particularly severe or when they get repetitive, they become a kind of class, what we talk about as traumatic dreams. And there's a big debate about this, but some clinicians will say, you know, that's a sign of the mind, mental function is being disturbed, often by trauma. But the other way to think about that is that, you know, yes, trauma will have a disturbance on the entirety of the human, and the dream might be a way of trying to process that trauma, to try to put the mind right, you know? And so in that sense, dreams are a kind of problem-solving or attempt to repair our experience. And so with Mandela's dream, I mean, I think he was able to use his dream as a way of thinking about his political condition. Mm-hmm. And so for me, the distinction is not as important, perhaps, as a clinician would make.
Right. So once you started kind of developing this deeper interest in this area, did you notice anything new or different about yourself? Like, do you have dreams and nightmares or things that you remember? And if so, how did that impact you?
Yeah, that's a tough question. It took me a long time to be able to think about that and write about that. You know, there is one little chapter in the new book. We're going to go right for it, Andrew.
Sure.
There's one chapter in the new book, which is an alphabet book. So the chapters are organized like an alphabet. So S, you know, A is for attention, C is for cancer, and so on. And I did write about one of my own dreams or a series of my own dreams in the chapter S is for suicide. And, you know, I had a difficult time as a young adult. I had a very strong conflict with my family. My father at one point effectively, disowned me.
Oh, wow.
He declared me dead to him. So, you know, wow. That was a really, a really difficult thing. And I had some suicidal ideation, and not surprisingly, I had really difficult nightmares at the time.
Right.
I didn't connect them. It took me a long time. It took me 20 years, you know, to make sense of those dreams as being about what I was going through. But in almost every one of those nightmares, there was a figure. Sometimes it was a stranger. Sometimes it was me. Sometimes it was my family dog. You know, there's always a figure in those dreams that became severed in some horrific way, you know, like body being ripped apart in a big accident or, you know, there was very endless variations on it. But I realized 20 years later that the dream was showing me what I had gone through, you know, that my life was kind of ripped in half at that moment.
Wow.
And so it was, again, a sort of a personal example of how dreams are evidence for your lived experience. They help you show you what you're going through, mm-hmm. but they put it in a new form, which is to me a very important political point.
Right. Wow. So I want to come back to the book in a minute, but before we dive deeper into the book, I want to touch on, so we have this Museum of Dreams. How did that come about, and tell us about it? What is it exactly?
Yeah, when I was doing research for the book that came just before the one you mentioned, it was a book called Dreaming in Dark Times. It was where I was really trying to marry political theory with psychosocial studies and think about dreams as having social and political content. So the book begins with Mandela, with one of that Mandela dream that I describe. And in the course of writing that book, which is all about historical figures, I found all these amazing dreams in the historical record, you know, but they're kind of everywhere when you're looking for them, but also they're hard to find. If you just like want to find, oh, did Nelson Mandela have a nightmare? You can't find that unless you happen upon it in the biography.
Right.
And so I realized, you know, someone should build an archive where you can search for these things. And then I thought it started that way. It's a very simple kind of collection of all the things I'd found. And then we built a kind of public-facing interface through this museum, the website, mm-hmm. and called it the Museum of Dreams. And then very quickly, like within literally months, I started having collaborators call me from all over the world. And we started, you know, doing different kinds of projects together. I have a huge, huge range of collaborators. And the Museum of Dreams now I think of as this kind of collaboratorium. You know, it's a museum that's built of all these different relationships and right. researchers, clinicians, institutions, and so on.
Wow. So tell us how you organize it. Like I'm thinking to myself, you know, I wonder when did we first have the first mentionings of dreams or nightmares in history? Because people would have to mention them somewhere, they'd have to write them down or paint about them or something.
Basically, dreams are as old as history itself. That would be the shorthand way of talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just still trying to remember what grief. It's G. G is for grief. God, it took me a long time to get there.
that's all right. We're not testing you, and you're not going to get a grade. but you know, you raised something that I never thought about before, and it's like, you know, I'm trying to think to myself, if I were reviewing very old, you know, text or artifacts or things, how would I know and how would the person at the time know or create a distinction, and maybe they didn't create a distinction, between a dream and some sort of a religious thing, like, you know, this is, you know, a higher power speaking to me or something, or maybe mm-hmm. they combine the. Can you clarify that for us? Like, I don't even know how that would have played out.
Yeah, well, I think that's a distinction that, you know, the ancients didn't make. So that it's true. I mean, that's why they're in the Bible. And that dream, you know, the early passages in the Bible are so attentive to dreams because they are assumed to come from God. That God, this is how God communicates with humans, is through dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that's the history of health, by the way, that, you know, we would have these, what they were called as Asclepion, for the god Asclepius, who was the god that would deliver dreams. If you were ill, you would go to the Asclepion, you would sleep at the Asclepion, and you would wake up in hopes of having the god visited you in the dream. And either the god would tell you what you were suffering from, or they would dispense a cure in the form of the dream. And the priests at the Asclepion would be there to help you think about this. And, you know, they were early sanctuaries. And that form of medicine, you know, went on for almost 1,000 years. And the only kind of, it was considered a kind of cult in a way, but the only thing that displaced it culturally in that part of the world was Jesus, when Jesus came.
Mm-hmm.
And that this was a new kind of, you know, he had a different kind of a healing touch. And it changed the whole, you know, thinking about the relationship between religion and health.
Wow. Wow. I mean, there's such a big conversation that can happen in there. Mm-hmm. But let's do this. I'm at a point where I've got to take a commercial break. And I know that you also did a dream project related to COVID, which I think is something that we really should talk about. So let's take a break, and we'll be back in just a minute on Sleep Science Today, and we'll talk about the COVID Dream Project with Professor Slavinsky. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today.
All right, we're back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We are talking all about dreams and nightmares and more than that. So before the break, we said we're going to talk about COVID and the COVID Dream Project. What is that? Fill us in.
Yeah, that was a fun one. During COVID, a really wonderful curator from the London Museum called me up, and she was interested in, the London Museum was interested in collecting COVID ephemera. This was really early on in the first year of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And she called me up just for a consultation because, you know, everyone was talking about dreams and social media was filled with people reporting their COVID dreams and so on. And she said, you know, I really want to collect COVID dreams. And so, you know, we had a long conversation and one thing led to another. And the next thing I know is I was partnering with her and we started collecting. The museum sent out a big call and we got a huge response. More than 1,000 people responded within the first week. It was overwhelming. So we set up these Zoom interviews. I got together a small team. I got together some clinicians from Birkbeck University, which is in London. I thought it might be good for Londoners to speak to Londoners. Mm-hmm. And we set up these Zoom interviews where we talked to people about their COVID dreams. It was a fascinating project. And then the London Museum took them all into their oral testimony collection. So they're housed actually in the museum as part of their permanent collection. And then we built a kind of forward-facing version on the Museum of Dreams, where all these testimonies are available to the public, and you can read those testimonies. And that we did some wonderful portraits of the dreamers themselves. I took a photographer and went to London, and we shot some of these folks in their homes, which is where most of the interviews took place. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a fascinating project.
So I'm curious, through that particular project, were there any themes that evolved or anything interesting that was kind of different than what you had been seeing in your other work?
Yeah, well, I mean, my colleague at the University of Montreal, Tor Nelson, he writes about how COVID is a kind of worldwide dreaming event that it changed the amount that people were dreaming about, but we were all kind of dreaming about COVID during that mm-hmm. time, in the sense, you know, that, and for very, depending on our circumstances, we all had different kinds of dreams, but it was the first time that the world was all kind of dreaming about the same thing, which was fascinating. And I took that as evidence again of the kind of social and political importance for dream life, because you see how porous our dream life is to whatever's happening socially and politically. And yeah, I mean, I think that we were dealing with a lot of new things, a lot of new protocols. There was a lot of anxiety, and we learned that dream life became a kind of place where people processed what was happening. All these changes that were happening socially. So we learned that dreaming, there was already quite a bit of neuroscientific evidence for this, that dreams are a really important place for learning, for emotional processing, for emotional regulation, and so on. So we just got a lot of qualitative data to sort of show that to be true, that mm-hmm. dreams are a place for processing the challenges we face in daily life.
So I would imagine, but that's a total guess, and I could be wrong. I've been wrong once before in my life, I think. but so COVID-related dreams, I'm wondering, were they more nightmares or more dreams? Were they more calming and peaceful? Were they more scary and unsettling? I'm guessing they're more scary and unsettling, but I don't know. Tell me.
I think we had a range. I mean, it really depended on the person's circumstance. Yes, there was a lot of anxiety, a lot of dreams about travel, interestingly. A lot of processing older experiences, like people had sort of time in their lives to kind of deal with stuff that had been there. One of my favorite interviews was with we were interviewing the mother, actually, but in, as it was during COVID, the children burst into the interview. There was a nine-year-old kid that we interviewed. And this nine-year-old kid was amazing. And she had a really interesting dream about being trapped in her iPad. Hmm. Like she was in the iPad. She couldn't really move out of being faced forward in this kind of screen. And I took that as a very interesting and kind of telling COVID dream, insofar as we were all so focused on the screens. Most of our entire interface with the outside world was happening through screens. Yeah. And in particular for the kids, because they were, you know, all of a sudden forced into this great experiment of online learning. You know, they were 9-year-old kids and younger were being forced to sit in front of their screens all day as a way of doing school. So, you know, the dream was kind of processing that huge transformation in her life. And that could have only happened during COVID because it was really reflective of what she was going through. So for me, that was a really kind of a signal dream about the kind of how dreams during COVID were working. Mm-hmm. She also had a dream about going back into her mother's womb. She kept having to go back. And it was nice because the interview, you sort of saw the mother and child thinking together about this dream. The mother had never heard this dream before as we were interviewing her. And so she was asking the child, her name was Iris. She was asking the child about, you had to go back in mommy's womb? And she said, yeah, I had to go back. We had to keep going back in. And then the child made the association. She said, it was like lockdown. We had to keep going back into it. And so it became this very interesting dialogue between mother and child where the child was imagining, like she was figuring in her dream life, a way to understand this experience of having to go back into lockdown. And for that particular family, it was a kind of a safe environment. The home and having to go into lockdown was not a terrible thing. It was and so the idea of going back into the womb was kind of a good representation for that family of what the experience of lockdown was like. You know, it was good. It was time with your family. It was intimate. It was, you know, but that wasn't true for everybody, for sure.
Right. Wow. So in general, the visitors/users of the museum, let me put it that way, are you finding, is it mostly for sharing stories and provoking thought, or do you also have like researchers from a sleep science perspective trying to study dreams either from a psychological perspective or a, you know, how do we stop nightmares? Who's the audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do a lot of different things. Some of our partners are artists who are very interested in doing creative projects, try to extend the logic of dreaming as a kind of like creative work. So there's those kinds of partners. We do have a really big new project. It's called Dreamers of the 21st Century. And that's, we're actually trying to gather dream data, trying to gather testimony that people have about their dream life. And we're doing that through various community partnerships. So rather than just gathering it, you know, randomly from the public, we have very specific community partners. So one of our most recent projects was, for example, with Moss Park, which is a safe consumption site here in Toronto, where I live. Mm-hmm. And this is a community health site that also does safe supervised consumption, which is to say there's nursing staff and trained healthcare workers who are there while people are using pre-obtained drugs in order to reverse overdose. It's a community-based form of healthcare that is trying to keep people alive who are mostly injection drug users.
Right.
So we did a project with them where we talked to this community about their dream life. And this is a very vulnerable community that, you know, about half of the people that we spoke to are unhoused. You know, all the range of social determinants of health are the things that these people face, not surprisingly. And so they come there to be safe while they're using drugs. And we experience, first of all, huge sleep deprivations, huge issues around sleep, and therefore huge issues around dreaming. And that was a really interesting finding that certain communities that are facing social and political challenges suffer from dream loss, which is to say that they also lose this really important mental activity that helps people cope. Mm-hmm. So that was a really interesting finding. There's a huge range of people that we work with, and of course, dreaming, like any human experience, there's so many ways in, which is why I love dreams. You can talk to a big range of people.
Well, so if someone who's listening to this show feels that they have some interesting things to contribute, Do you accept things from the public? How does that work? How do you get the information material that you actually have in the museum?
Yeah, we work. People often reach out, and that's often how, like the London project, for example, when the curator reached out to me, and that turned into a partnership project. You know, as a as a university-based researcher, things move really slowly. We have to do ethics, you know, review applications and so on and so on. So it's, you know, it's not like a public-facing museum where you come in and you, you know, might learn about something and then contribute to the collection or whatever else. It's a bit slower, and that maybe someday we could have an actual Museum of Dreams that people could visit, you know, like any other museum. That would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. There should be one. I don't know why there isn't one in the world already, but yeah, I mean, absolutely. As I said, most of our projects are either commissioned or they work through these community-based partnerships. But yeah, if anyone's out there and has a really interesting idea, especially that's based in a community context, I'd love to hear from them.
Fantastic. So I'm looking at your website right now, and for listeners, it's museumofdreams.org. And I'm looking at the menu, and you have a podcast, you have publications, mm-hmm. you have the collection, you have Dreamers of the 21st Century. Can you tell us a little bit about the different things that people would find if they go to the website?
Yeah. So in the collection, it's really, like I said, it's sort of an archive where people who are researchers or artists or have done sort of work on dreams that exist in the historical record, that's what you'll find in the collection. So, for example, there's a little, I don't know, maybe you can pick one off the top and I can just sort of talk a little bit about it. But okay. There's a little thing that I've written, for example, on Mandela's dream. There's all kinds of stuff in there. The Dreamers of the 21st Century is the sort of new, we're gathering new dream material from people who are alive today, and that's the community-based partnership one. Mm-hmm. And the podcast is just, the interviews with, for example, the Londoners were so rich that we turned some of those interviews into podcast episodes. So, because you get to hear people, to hear people's voice, it's always a really important way to hear from people. So we just have different sort of outlets for the kind of research that we do.
Wow. Yeah. I'm looking, as we're talking, I'm looking at the website and I see these things are broken down by essay, book review, mm-hmm. conversation, dance, film and essay, essay and film, musical album. So you really have all these different media that are used to demonstrate these things. So these are artists who create these based upon their own dreams or dreams that they've learned of?
Yeah. So it's true. It's a little bit confusing sometimes for people to kind of find their way in. Our focus is the social and political life of dreams. So we tend to focus on people that have done that kind of work. So I'll give you an example. Tim Hetherington was a wonderful photojournalist he was a war photographer, basically, an American war photographer. And he covered the wars in Iraq. And he did this incredible series called Sleeping Soldiers. Mm-hmm. And they're just a series of portraits of some of the soldiers. He was embedded, as all journalists were during the war in Iraq, the wars on terror. And he's traveling with this particular platoon of soldiers, and he ends up doing these portraits. But the portraits are of these men sleeping, and they're beautiful portraits, and they're very vulnerable. And Tim was very interested in the sort of masculinity that you know war engenders, let's say. Mm-hmm. And he kind of found a way to turn it on its head, and in these portraits, because the men are very, you know, when you're watching someone sleep, you know, they're in a very vulnerable state. So it was a very interesting way to document what was happening during the war. And I loved the series, and I saw it when it was first shown. It was shown as a series of billboards in Toronto during the Contact Photo Festival. And I was always very admiring of Tim's work. Tim was killed by enemy fire in Libya, I think. And there's a trust that holds those photographs. So the director of that trust, of the Tim Hetherington Trust, wrote a little essay about those photographs, about that series. And so, for example, that's one of the pieces of our collection is the essay by the director of the Tim Hetherington Trust. And then we have there his film and some of the photographs. So you can come and it's almost like a virtual exhibit. You can come and see and learn about Tim Hetherington's work this way. But mm-hmm. it's just a kind of way, the museum is just a way to house these various projects that are interested in the social and political life of dreams. Could be a photographer, it could be a historian, it could be you know, a clinician. It could be a community health worker. There's a whole bunch of stuff in there, which the museum houses.
Right. Wow. Wow. It's really interesting. It's something so unique and different. I have to take our second break, so I'm going to do that now. When we come back, I have more questions for you about the book. So stay tuned. We'll be back, and we'll talk about the new book. We'll see you on the other side of the break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. Welcome back. I'm Andrew Kolsky, your host of Sleep Science Today. We're talking with Professor Sharon Slavinsky. And as we said earlier in the show, she recently wrote a book, An Alphabet for Dreamers, How to See the World with Eyes Closed. And so obviously from the title and from some statements you've made earlier, I'm assuming you go through the alphabet and each letter then represents something. Tell us, how did you come up with this format, and how does it work for the book, and how did you decide, you know, which story matches which letter?
Yeah, it was a bit of a puzzle to put it together, but I don't know about you, but I love alphabet books, and I always have as a kid, and there's something about kind of the marriage between image and text, you know, that you often find in alphabets. Of course, they're children's books. They're meant to teach people to read using images. But I thought, why can't I use that format as a way to kind of teach people how to think about dreams, which are, of course, also a kind of image. And I also wanted to write something for a more general audience. You know, as a scholar's scholar, a lot of my books are read by other scholars, but they don't get huge range. But I realized with dreams, you know, they have a huge appeal, and people really want to learn about their dreams. So that this book, An Alphabet for Dreamers, is really meant for this more general audience to learn about their dreams and about, in particular, about the social and political history of dreaming. Mm-hmm. And the book is made up of a range of both historical figures like Harriet Tubman, who, for example, really used her dreams as a way to guide her work, bringing people to freedom during that period in the United States, and some of the contemporary dreamers from, for example, the COVID project. There's quite a few of those figures, really good stories in that book as well. And I worked with an illustrator, a wonderful illustrator, Melinda Josie, who did an image for each of the chapters. So there's 26 beautiful watercolors in the text as well. Wow. But yeah, it was tricky. I mean, I had to, each chapter really focuses kind of on one dreamer and trying to sort of tease out the social and political lessons from each of these dreamers. And it was tricky. I mean, it is a bit of a constraint to work with the alphabet, but it was a fun constraint, a creative one, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure it took some time to kind of think through that. I'm curious about this question because, for example, you mentioned Harriet Tubman, and you said how she kind of used her dreams to help her achieve her goals and her vision. It doesn't have to be her, but maybe her. Can you think of an example from the book to help bring that statement to life? So someone, you know, like Harriet Tubman has these dreams, and then she uses it to kind of help her to achieve what she's going for. Can you tell us more? How does that work? What does that look like?
Yeah, with the Tubman's in the chapter L is for liberation. And there's a long history in the Black tradition, in the Black radical tradition, of using dream life as a kind of medium, as a means for in the freedom struggle in the United States. And Tubman's a great example of that. And she often talked with her biographers. We don't have a Tubman's voice directly. I mean, Tubman did not learn how to read and write because of the laws around literacy in the United States in the antebellum period. But all of her biographers talk about how she used her dreams as a kind of guide when she would go back. She went back into the slave states some 13 times to liberate men and women and children from the condition of slavery. And she was amazing. They called her General Tubman because she, you know, found a way to escape, you know, the people who were commissioned to try to capture her and so on. And her dreams were her guide. And you know, that follows from a whole principle of an alternate form of communication that enslaved people had to use to kind of find their way to freedom. And attending to her dream life was just that, literally that medium, I guess, of liberation. Mm-hmm. So the book is trying to give lessons for how people can attend. A is for attention, and I spend a little bit of time trying to talk about the ways in which dreams kind of are a plea to pay attention to what's happening in the theater of our mind. And it also a little bit about why we don't pay attention to dreams in the contemporary era. And it's kind of a plea to bring dreams back as a way to see the world.
Right. Right. Well, that statement leads perfectly into the next question I had for you here, which is, you know, someone who reads the book, what can they learn from the book about listening to their own dreams?
Yeah, I keep the second last chapter, why, and where I speak directly to the reader and I offer some advice. So the chapter why is for you, Y-O-U, like literally for you.
Right.
And there I give sort of three concrete pieces of advice, which is, first of all, respect the value of sleep. I mean, you probably have a lot more to say about this. Listeners to this podcast will have a lot to say about this and probably do respect the value of sleep. But it's, you know, sleep has become such an arena of economic exploitation, you know, that people want to sell you stuff about sleeping better as if to make you more productive in your waking hours. But, you know, that's kind of a, you know, sleep shouldn't just be about recharging your batteries for the next days of work. You know, it's a much more important experience than that. And it's not surprising in that respect that many liberation movements are now seizing upon sleep as a kind of place of resistance. But it also, I think, when you to say, you know, respect the value of sleep is also to acknowledge that you have to surrender to sleep. You have to surrender. Your ego has to go quiet and something else happens while you're asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that principle of sort of respecting dream life, respecting sleep, respecting having to let go is one of the important things, sort of the condition for learning from your dreams. You know, there was a existential philosopher named Ludwig Binswanger who said, to dream just means I don't know what's happening. And that kind of surrendering to that experience of not knowing is sort of step one. The next piece of advice is to follow associations. So this is borrowed from Freud and from psychosocial studies, which is that you can break down any given dream into its elements, and then you begin to try to associate to each of those elements. So if you know, Mandela were a patient, for example, in a clinic, they would say, okay, well, tell me what it means to, what does this jail in Johannesburg mean? What does it mean that the world is empty? What does it mean that you walk to Soweto? And you try to get the person to associate to each of these elements. And this associative form of thinking is a very important non-rational form of thought. It's creative. It's about drawing you to your connections in life and whatnot. So that associative, to get into that associative mindset, to follow the associations that your dream is leading you on is kind of the second piece of advice. And then the third one is just simply to share your dreams. That, you know, it's so important. It's hard to overstate really how important it is to share your dreams. And you know, if you sleep next to somebody, wake up and tell them the dream you had, because it's a very intimate form of communication, and it's a way of kind of extending the power of the dream into waking life to share your dreams. I mean, the most famous example, of course, is Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous speech, you know, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, you know, where he talks about
dreaming,
the power of the dream. Yeah, but, I mean, that's a very kind of overdetermined example, but
right.
The principle is the same. It is about connecting people. It is about sharing this particular form of knowledge that comes from dreaming once you relinquish the ego. And it's about, you know, bringing into view a whole different world, back to MLK, you know, about what's possible, a world that has yet to come. And sharing your dreams is the mechanism by which we bring that world into view.
Yeah, that really is a good example. It really helps to kind of bring it to make sense for me anyway, to really understand it. So we are close to running out of time. So I want to ask you my last question, which is, I'd love to know, what are you working on now and what's coming next?
Yeah, I think we'll keep working away on the Dreamers of the 21st Century project. I think we might do something. We're trying to do something at the UN meetings in New York City in the fall. That's not for sure yet. And we're hoping to have a big conference or symposium, I guess, around this time next year. About, it's going to be called Liberatory Dreaming, I think here in Toronto. So we'll see. Yeah, I mean, I'm always looking forward to new projects and new connections and... lots to come.
Right. Wow. Well, this has been incredibly interesting to me because it's such a different take on sleep than we normally cover on this show. And it's really nice to be able to spend some time talking about it. And I encourage people to check out the website, museumofdreams.org, and you'll see all the things that we were talking about here. And obviously, where can they get the book? Is it on Amazon or where do they find
it? Yeah, Amazon. Any of your major bookstores should either have it or easily order it. Yeah, absolutely.
So an alphabet for dreamers. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again for taking the time to share this with us. Thank you for doing the work that you do and putting all that together, because I'm assuming nothing like that existed before. So this is great that it's now available. So thank you for all of that.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
All right, and for those of you listening, again, I do encourage you to check out the website and check us out next week. Every single week, we have a new episode for you about something interesting related to sleep and helping you to sleep better and make more sense of sleep. You can visit us at www.sleepsciencetoday.com, and we look forward to seeing you on a future episode. So thanks for joining us today.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.